You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, July 9th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Secret Law. It's the big time. New York Times, Wall Street Journal, outlining just what is so offensive to democracy in regards to the NSA spying scandal. Meanwhile, in Quebec, massive train accident carrying crude oil leaves at least 13 dead, nearly 50 missing. Indiana putting the anti in anti-gay. And more arrests on Moral Monday in North Carolina. Meanwhile, in Wisconsin, a late-night anti-abortion law, or I should say signed by Scott Walker late night Friday night, is not quite struck down, but stayed. Also, the internet-ronteurs speak out against the dirty masses who are striking or were on strike running the San Francisco, well, I guess the Bay Area transit system. And Rand Paul's aide wants to remind you just how many of those NAACP leaders were Republicans, and also that white should secede from this country because it's getting too brown. Meanwhile, in Egypt, 51 people killed as the military fires into protests. The military have appointed a new president, or I should say prime minister, not necessarily boding terribly well for democracy. The U.S. government still continues to try and determine whether or not it was a coup, or I guess trying to massage what the word coup means, because of its implication on the $1.5 billion worth of aid we give ostensibly to the country of Egypt, but mostly, I guess, to the military. We will be talking about that more as the week goes on. Really just a bad situation there, and I'm not sure exactly at any given point what would have made it less bad. Fears that Egypt is headed towards a civil war of some sort abound. And Elliot Spitzer has been making all the rounds on, I think he's been on every single MSNBC show over the last 18 hours to announce that he is going to be running for New York City. Is it comptroller or controller? It's comptroller.
Comptroller.
Some people say controller.
I'm sure people do want to be the controller.
I was thinking about
the comptroller.
Yes, I was thinking about he comptrolls the finances of the city. The most interesting aspect of this, of course, is that the city, through its pension funds, has potentially a lot of influence over the governance of corporations. Now, it's not quite clear exactly how much influence the individual comptroller has. There are committees that are set up that also sort of provide the guidance for these pension funds in terms of how they vote and what they can do in terms of forcing certain changes in corporate governance if they hold a lot of shares in any given corporation. But there is some speculation that for a guy like Spitzer, who has his issues with Wall Street, that this could be a means in which he imposes certain corporate governance. I mean, I think the other story, obviously, is that he is starting up his political career again. And I was thinking about inviting him onto the show. I don't know if it's too narrow of an issue, having to do with New York. And I think I've just seen so many interviews with him at this point that it may be redundant. But it's a fascinating exchange on Morning Joe this morning that I don't know how much was revealed here, but of course, everyone knows the story at this point. 5 years ago, Eliot Spitzer was the governor of New York State. He was ostensibly investigated because a bank notified the IRS that he was pulling out sums of money that appeared to be designed to avoid the reporting requirements. If you pull out anything more than $10,000 in cash from a bank account, the bank is required to report this to federal officials. And this, of course, is how Rush Limbaugh got busted for his, what was it, Percocet or?
No, it's...
Hillbilly heroin, I know, is what the nickname is for the drug that he was apparently...
Oxycontin.
Oxycontin. And he was paying off his cleaning lady to get him more, et cetera, et cetera. And ostensibly, the story goes that Spitzer at one point pulled out $9,500 and this led to a massive investigation. I believe the story is, which we have really have not heard, and this is all speculation on my part, but Eliot Spitzer made some extremely powerful enemies in his time as New York State Attorney General. And I'm quite convinced that some of those enemies, be it heads of banks or investment firms, must have had private investigators trying to figure out exactly what they could find on Spitzer. And that information made its way to the Bush Department of Justice. And the rest is, as they say, history. Nevertheless, and frankly, I think I've said on this program in various times that from a public policy standpoint, I don't have a problem with prostitution. I think it should be legalized. The biggest problems with prostitution come in the exploitation of sex workers, which is a function of prostitution being illegal. And, however, it's also, there's a tremendous amount of hypocrisy involved in someone who, as Attorney General, was prosecuting Johns and then was engaging in the same act. I think had he not been so, or had he not engaged in any type of policy to further the prosecution of Johns, it wouldn't have been as much of an issue in my mind anyways. The rest is political. And so too is this question as to whether or not you need to be banished from politics forever if you do something like that. I mean, certainly there was a price paid in that he resigned from his position as governor. And I imagine, though I'm not sure I've seen any reporting on this, that prosecutors basically said, that's the deal we'll make. No further prosecution if you resign. Because the amount of tax dollars spent on a prosecution of something, such a low-level crime, would probably not be the best use of resources for a guy who's going to fight it in that way. And they certainly got a pound of flesh. And so understand it is in that context in which when Spitzer shows up on Morning Joe, and who was it? It wasn't Joe. It was
Mark Halpern.
Halpern. They really, really don't want to challenge Joe's job over there by putting someone in with any type of charisma. And, of course, generally,
like, hi, I will be filling in for Joe.
I will be filling in for Joe. Apparently, they couldn't get Mike Barnicle. He was too busy, I guess, at his altar for Whitey Bulger. And, you know, this is a show that is often, that is headed by a former politician who, at the very least, we never quite found out exactly what went on, but there was some scandal surrounding Joe Scarborough with the death of an intern in his office. But not that there was maybe anything to that scandal, but that's just the way the media works. Mike Barnicle, of course, was fired from the Boston Herald for plagiarism, which is seems to me a fairly important ethical violation when you're a journalist. It's hard, you know, I mean, you'll recall that when other journalists have made up stuff, the outcry that some of these journalists would get paid $20,000 to go to a speaking engagement, it is pretty stunning that Barnicle doesn't really take much grief for his role in that, in plagiarizing as a journalist, ostensibly now a new job in journalism. But be that as it may, here is the exchange between Halpern and Spitzer. Try and see if you get a sense of where Halpern's mentality lies when it comes to Spitzer. I mean, yes, you're on this show. Obviously, there's no reason to give Spitzer a free pass. But at the end of the day, the issue is, as it will be with Wiener in some respects, the issue is, what does the electorate say? Here's Halpern and Spitzer this morning from Morning Joe.
Do you win this position? Will you ever lie to the public once elected?
No.
Never.
No.
So Meek asked you in the beginning how people can be confident that there won't be a repeat of the behavior before, and you said you reflected. Just speak a little bit more about that. What does that mean? That what you've done in the last 5 years, how does that convince people and reassure people that it won't happen again?
I've tried to do things that matter in a small and quiet way. You know, that doesn't persuade people about recurrence, but I've also thought deeply and recognized that I would need to answer these questions, and I've said, look at the pain I've caused to...
But if you win, you will not really have paid... You've paid some price, obviously, but you will not have had your public career ended. So again, wouldn't that, to some extent, reinforce the notion that you could do what you wanted to do?
No, I'm not quite sure. I mean, and I think that there has been a substantial price to be paid, and I'll let others...
That is just a stupid question. aside from the fact that I don't know what the New York Post has on its cover today, but I'm sure.
Yesterday was here we ho again.
Yes. I think it's pretty hard to say that he hasn't paid a price. And certainly there is very little precedent. Very little precedent in American public life of politicians who have their careers summarily ended by a sex scandal or, say, Ollie North maybe lying to Congress or, I mean, so on and so on. I mean, it's just an absurd question, the idea that he hasn't paid a price. Meanwhile, where's Mike Barnicle? What price did Mike Barnicle pay? All right, continue.
The New York Post front page, by the way, is Sleazy Does It.
There you go.
You know, determine big, small, adequate, or inadequate, but resigning the governorship and then dealing with the aftermath of that and dealing with everything that has flown from it, that was a pretty significant
price. Are there any things people in elective office, a high office like governor of New York, could do that involve law-breaking, lying to the public that you would consider as a voter disqualifying, where nothing's disqualifying if a person comes back and says, look what I've done for the last 5 years, look at my great ideas, or are there things that are disqualifying?
Sure, like what? Sure there are. I mean, I think there's...
What would be disqualifying?
I think there is a difference between private and public lives, and I'm not the one to begin to articulate this distinction at this point, because I'm in a uniquely bad position to try to articulate it.
Right.
But I think there is a divide there that is something we do want to think about at a certain point in time.
All right, I will step in and answer this question. If you engage in activities that, as a public official, that abuses your office, the position that you're holding. If you're involved in graft, if you're involved in using the apparatus of government to further your own ends, if you are breaking laws that are a function of your position, not as an individual, that is a rather big distinction. I mean, you know, Buddy Cianci I think it was the chief of the state police to hold down his wife's lover while he beat him up with a bat, I think. I mean, I'm doing this from recollection. And then went to jail and came back out and was reelected mayor of Providence. That seems to be the decision of the voters at that point. Personally, I feel like if you abuse your position in some fashion to enrich yourselves, or that has some material degradation of the systems of our government, that's very different than engaging in illegal behavior that has no impact short of the way the public perceives you on that position.
Any interest in finding out what Buddy Cianci actually assaulted that guy with?
Yeah, what was it?
A lit cigarette, an ashtray, and a fireplace log.
Okay. Apologies to Buddy Cianci.
There.
It wasn't a baseball bat. That would have been an upgrade. Good.
Lying as the governor of New York.
Well, it depends.
It's not
about,
disqualifying.
It depends about what. I think we all know that politicians dissemble all the time about negotiations, what on substantive issues and probably on personal issues as well. And so it is a question of where, when, how, and on what issue. I think there's slightly greater subtlety to this in terms of the art of both governance and how you then determine whether what people have done is disqualifying.
So just one more. So is an elected official, governor of New York, comptroller of New York, lying about his or her personal life when asked about it in a public capacity, that's fine?
No, I didn't say it's fine, but you asked if it was disqualifying. And I think that, again, I think we're going down here a path here where it requires more time to really parse out what that boundary is between the private and the public. Now, I'll give you something that's disqualifying. If people lie about their taxes, not having paid their taxes and all the rest, then I think that is disqualifying.
But you lied about illegal activity.
Well, I lied about personal sexual activity, yes, and I did that. I'm not trying to diminish it.
You weren't lying about an affair, a consensual affair. You were lying about illegal activity.
Okay, that's correct.
So you're saying that lying about illegal activity to you is not disqualifying.
This is, I will let the public make that that determination.
There you go. So interesting exchange, and, you know, I certainly would not be terribly happy with my spouse if she was engaging in this activity. And I don't know that this would be a guy that I would say, like, hey, I really feel I can trust you with some, I don't know. I mean, but that's not really the issue here. You know, and it's now up to the voters to decide. Who they're going to vote for. I find it interesting. I've had him on this program many times as a guest. I've been on his programs many times, both of them. And from a public policy standpoint, I remain a fan. Anybody who is going to be that aggressive about going after the bankers is someone I would like to see in office, frankly. And, you know, it's up to his wife as to whether or not she wants to still be involved in that with that guy. And at this point, she has, for whatever reason, has made that decision. All right, let's turn to something that is a little bit more meaty, shall we? Now, I know Michael spoke about this New York Times piece. I want to talk about it more. It's something that we have been talking on this program for literally for a couple of years anyways, when Mark Udall and Ron Wyden were making their concerns, and maybe I'm understating this, that the U.S. government was interpreting the Patriot Act in particular in a way that most Americans would find shocking, in a way that they felt was unconstitutional. Through that time, we have said that the implications of this are essentially that there is secret law. And for the past couple of weeks, in the wake of Snowden's revelations, this has been the primary issue as far as I can tell. We still don't know nearly all there is to know about this NSA surveillance. Its potential for abuse, it's already being abused. But what is clear is that there's abuse in the sense that there has been set up a completely unaccountable, a completely opaque regime of secret law, which in and of itself is an abuse of the law that Congress has passed. There is no other example in our system of government. In fact, I would argue this is not even within our system of government. This is outside our system of government. It is fundamentally anti-democratic. It is quite possible that these laws, Section 715 of the Patriot Act, the FISA court amended law passed in 2008, could be adjudicated in front of the Supreme Court. It could be found that the NSA, the FBI, et al. Are operating under the auspices of these laws in a way that does not contradict or run afoul of the Constitution, particularly the Fourth Amendment. And then the public would have the opportunity to react via their representatives, via their power in elections. But we don't have that here. All of this could be found to be legal. I still would have a problem with it. But that's very different than to say that this body of law, which supposedly allows the NSA and the FBI and whomever to engage in these activities is legal because we don't even know what the law is. And now that the New York Times apparently has gotten some additional documents and additional sources and has finally sort of picked up this angle, hopefully there'll be more attention paid to it. And right, in more than a dozen classified rulings, the nation's surveillance court, this is the FISA court, has created a secret body of law, giving the National Security Agency the power to amass vast collections of data on Americans while pursuing not only terrorism suspects, but also people possibly involved in nuclear proliferation, espionage, cyber attacks. And frankly, we don't know what else. We don't know what the definition of a terrorist is. As far as this court determines what it is, we don't know what the definition of, and we will talk about this as we get further in the piece, but essentially the FISA court has unilaterally, outside the system of law that we have in this country, created and expanded the exceptions to the Fourth Amendment. And we don't know really the full breadth of what those exceptions are and for whom they are, what agencies and what they have to prove to be allowed those exceptions. We don't know that in the present, and we don't know that in the future. We have no sense where it can go. We can't even speculate on it. And that's because all this is done in secret. The rulings, some nearly 100-page law long, reveal that the court has taken on a much more expansive role by regularly assessing broad constitutional questions and establishing important judicial precedents. I don't know under what authority the FISA court has the ability to do this. I don't know if you can even statutorily imbue a court that is subsidiary to the Supreme Court with this ability. As far as I know, the Constitution only allows for the Supreme Court to make final adjudications on the constitutionality of these issues. There is no way, at least as far as we know, and certainly if history is an indication, there's no way for any of these cases to be appealed to the Supreme Court. It is created a parallel system of courts in this country. And unlike the Supreme Court, where you have both a plaintiff and a defendant, here you only have a plaintiff. Only the government comes and makes its case. There is no one who makes the adversarial case. And we have an adversarial system of law in this country. This is stunning. And this is a court that was set up specifically to approve case-by-case wiretapping orders. This was set up as a magistrate, essentially. A federal secret magistrate providing some oversight on a case-by-case basis, saying whether or not this conforms to the law. Even then, it was fairly close to as rubber stamp as you could get it. But when a court rules on something, when it makes a precedent, it becomes the law until it is challenged in a court that is higher higher than it, essentially, which is why these cases wind their way up to the Supreme Court, or the Supreme Court rejects them because they don't see a significant enough problem for them to deal with, and it ends at a federal appeals court. We don't have this system here. One of the court's most important decisions, the judges have expanded the use in terrorism cases of legal principle known as the special needs doctrine and carved out an exception to the Fourth Amendment's requirement of a warrant for searches and seizures. Now, maybe they have and maybe they haven't expanded that special needs beyond terrorism. Maybe they have and maybe they haven't expanded the definition of terrorism. We know that if you chain yourself to a tree and you block a pipeline, there are agencies that put you on a list of terrorists. You're an eco-terrorist. We know that, at least coming out of these fusion agencies, we know that at least some federal officials perceived Occupy protests in the same way that they did potential terrorist threats. We don't know if this information can be accessed based on this special need to make sure that these protesters don't get out of hand. We don't know. The special needs doctrine was originally established in 1989 by the Supreme Court in a ruling allowing the drug testing of railway workers, saying that you can have a small intrusion into the privacy of these railway workers if the government needs to fight an overriding public danger. In other words, that you may get a train accident like they just had in Quebec. I don't know that that was the cause of it, a function of impairment by the train workers, but that's the idea. And so the FISA court has ruled that the NSA's collection and examination of Americans' communication data to track possible terrorists does not run afoul of the Fourth Amendment. I mean, I just don't know under what authority the FISA court is operating to adjudicate these things. Now, you should know that the FISA court, it consists of 11 judges appointed by the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. The fact that they're all Republican, the fact that the Supreme Court, John Roberts has the ability to cherry pick judges to sit on this court to hear a specific genre of cases is problematic enough. I would still have a problem if it was Justice Ginsburg sitting on as the Supreme Court justice picking 11 Democrats to specifically hear this. If this court was adjudicating things and creating law, I have no problem with courts creating law. It's just that it's done in a completely parallel track and there is no ability to appeal it and there's no one there to argue why this is a bad idea. I mean, talk about judicial activism. This is just absurd. And then there are quotes from a couple of legal experts who basically say, this seems like a legal stretch to me. Again, the two issues here are that there is does not seem to be redress. There does not seem to be parties to call for redress. There is no two sides to the argument here when the FISA court hears this. It is incredibly problematic. And the silence from the legal establishment, again, is just, it's deafening. I mean, why is it only places like the Center for Constitutional Rights? Why is it only the Brennan Center? Where is the American Bar Association? Where is every single legal institution in the country on this? It's. I want to say stunning, but I know I overuse that word, but it's shockingly stunning.
In an unbelievable way.
In an unbelievable way. The Wall Street Journal has what can be read as a companion piece to this, digging deeper into the one of the rulings by, or a body of rulings by the FISA court, wherein it redefined the word relevant as to what the FBI could seek and get in the course of an investigation. Now, even I think the word investigation in this case is also incredibly malleable. What is it are they investigating? There's been no crime committed. They are not investigating. They are essentially trying to profile people. They are trying to find a class of people. They're not investigating a crime here. Right? Because the crime has yet to take place. In classified orders, starting in the mid-2000s, the court accepted that the term relevant could be broadened. And when they say accepted, what they're saying here is that the FBI or some other agency petitions the court, essentially, saying we need the term relevant to be broadened. And essentially, it's just the court deciding on their own. People with, I mean, do we really know the extent of what the expertise of these judges are in these cases? I don't know who is writing them briefs to argue that you shouldn't increase or broaden the meaning of the word relevant. Could be broadened to permit an entire database of records on millions of people, in contrast to a more conservative interpretation widely applied in criminal cases, in which only some of those records would likely be allowed. In other words, relevant means something in legal and criminal legal terms. It has already been defined through decades, maybe centuries, of criminal law. And this court, without the benefit of anybody making the case as to why it has been limited to what it's been limited to, accepts the petition to increase the definition, to expand the definition of the word relevant. Really to the point of where the word relevant has no relevance. Relevant is supposed to be a word that you apply to a set of information that limits it, right? It is a qualifying adjective. When it no longer reduces that which you may hoover up, I guess, it ceases to mean anything. And that's just in colloquial terms, but in legal terms, it means something very specific too, and it clearly means something narrower than what this court has unilaterally decided it's going to mean. The court's interpretation of the word enabled the government, under the Patriot Act, to collect the phone records of the majority of Americans. Relevant has long been a broad standard, but the way the court is interpreting it to mean, in effect, everything is new, says Mark Eckenweiler, a senior counsel at Perkins Coal, who until December was the Justice Department's primary authority on federal criminal surveillance law. I don't know that this guy had the opportunity to argue against whatever case it was or whatever the motion was filed. But it sounds like if he did, he lost. Two senators on the Intelligence Committee, Ron Wyden and Mark Udall, have confirmed that this aspect of the word relevance is what they were talking about. Or at least it's been confirmed by members of their offices. In 1991, the Supreme Court ruled on what the term relevant means. And it means if there's a reasonable possibility, that's in quotes, that those things will produce information related to the subject of the investigation. Now, as it's written here, it seems to mean the person or individual or crime that is being investigated. But in this instance, there is no person, no specific person, no specific crime that is being investigated. In criminal cases, courts have previously found that very large sets of information didn't meet the relevant standard because significant portions, innocent people's information, wouldn't be pertinent. But the FISA court has developed separate precedents centered on the idea that investigations to prevent national security threats are different from ordinary criminal cases. And then, of course, the issue is, what constitutes a national security threat? Again, we're back to this problem. The court's rulings on such matters are classified and almost impossible to challenge because of the secret nature of the proceedings. So we have this body of secret law that seems to be systemically impossible to know or to challenge. This in and of itself, regardless of what the NSA is doing with this stuff, regardless of the opportunity for corruption, this in and of itself should be enough to re-examine the whole infrastructure that has allowed for it. This in and of itself, the knowledge that, and because while we were speculating about this, Snowden's revelations have at least opened up the floodgates a little bit. So that now we're seeing these stories in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. It's nothing that we haven't been saying on this program for quite some time. And it's nothing that we didn't know in the context of, you know, Terror Tuesdays. But, God, I don't know what it's going to take for at least the legal establishment to say, you know, this
maybe
was,
we
this
have just, a little bit of a concern with precedents and common law being set without it being adjudicated properly. Maybe
there
that's
is
a
no
little
system
bit
of law in this country if this is let to be is allowed to exist. There is no system of law. It's meaningless. And why not just set up a whole series of other courts? I mean, this cuts both ways. One, why just have this exception, you know, for these investigations? Why not for all crime? And we don't know what constitutes national security. I mean, is this an existential threat? How many people need to be killed for it to reach the level of national security? We don't know. Presumably, there's some There's some finding by the FISA court as to what constitutes national security. They apparently can come up with their own findings on all these terms. And why not? Why not have it a separate system to deal with environmental law? Supreme Court can the Supreme Court justice can appoint those judges to just unilaterally decide without having any type of adversarial case in front of them. I mean, this is going in, and the king just decides. But in this case, he's farming it out to the dukes. It's really stunning to me. And I think, you know, one of the things that bedeviled me in my short legal student career, and perhaps which set me up to be completely disillusioned by my time at law school, was just that, you know, I grew up in with a family of lawyers, and there was a little bit of old-fashionedy, and the whole notion was that law is the glue that holds our the fabric of our society together, and that lawyers had a higher duty to society to make sure that the system of law was above reproach. I mean, I think this is why it took me so long to get over the 2000 election, because it was clearly and nakedly not a legal or a decision that was made not through any sort of accepted legal process and norms. And this is the same. I mean, this cuts fundamentally to our system of law in this country. And it's just stunning to see the silence by the legal community. And I'm not talking about those people whose jobs it is to advocate against this stuff. I mean, I just don't know how you can go into your law office today and think what you're doing is anything other than just simply transactional. As opposed to based on a system of law. It's just, I just find it stunning. I think I said that. All right, we got to take a break. We're going to head into the better half of the program, number 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. The IM is Majority FM. Not going to make a call for members today because it seems to have the opposite effect of what I like. But I will say, if you buy your crap through Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link. Costs you nothing. Very easy to do. Go click on it. Bottom of majority.fm homepage, bookmark it, buy your stuff through there. You will notice no difference. We will get a little kickback. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Got great news. Great news. We will talk about it tomorrow. But the app is back on, folks. And not just the app. I'm just going to tease this a little bit. But one of our amazing listeners has developed not just an app. We're going to have an app for your mobile device. But also now, I think we are not too far away from having an app for your Roku. Oh, yeah. Wait a second. Where's that? Come on. Gosh darn it, it's been so long since I hit that. Let me try that one more time. We've got an app for your... Where is my... for your Roku. You know, when you got to go that far for that, it doesn't really work. All right, folks, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. In the flip side, we're going to talk about that disaster up in Canada, which I think may have implications for Keystone. Should, at the very least, the anti-gay initiatives in Indiana. The wonderful story of Bin Laden getting stopped for a speeding ticket and apparently not getting caught. Wisconsin and Rand Paul. All that and more in the better half of the program. We'll be back in just a moment.